All right, so for Parshas Tazria, I thought we would look at the beginning of the Parsha, and the issue that doesn't catch as many headlines as Saras does, but it certainly should. We're told that when a woman has a baby, when a woman gives birth, so she has a period first of Tumah and then a period of Tahara. There's a period of the first 7 days for a baby boy, first 14 days for a baby girl, in which there is an automatic Nida-like status, as the Torah puts it, Kimei Nidas Devosati Tumah, she's impure like she is when she is a Nida. We'll talk about Tumah a little bit if we get that far at the end. And then there's a period of automatic Tahara, in which for 33 days for a boy, 66 days for a girl, she actually, the other way around, is not a Nida. Even if she sees Dam at that point, it does not make her a Nida. The application of these laws in our day is entirely different because of issues in terms of our comprehension of what it is that we're seeing in our perception of Dam. But leaving aside the application in our day, that's what the Torah presents here. So I want to talk about three issues that come up in this context. First, the Torah presents, as part of this conversation, the mitzvah of Bris Milah on day 8. So I want to talk a little bit about why Bris Milah is on day 8, because it's counterintuitive. With mitzvahs, generally, you do things as soon as you can. So why are we waiting for day 8? Number two, as part of this also, the Torah says that at the end of the period of impurity and purity, right, at day 40 or day 80, the woman brings a korban chatas. Chatas we usually render as a sin offering. What has she done wrong such that she should bring korban chatas? And then third, if we get that far, what is this business of Tahara and Tumah? I will note for you on the sheets, on source number 9, there are Shemos. I will be glad to put them in Geniza afterwards, or you could take them put them in Geniza yourself at such time as appropriate, or frame them and put them on your wall, and therefore they will not be treated with disrespect. Whatever you like. So, starting off first of all with Bris Milah being on day 8, which again, I would think you should do Bris Milah as soon as you possibly can. So we're going to see three different approaches which cast Bris Milah in different lights. The first approach is the Rambam. The first one I'm bringing, not chronologically in terms of the history of these approaches, but the Rambam in source number 1 from the Moreh Nevuchim. And he says it's a health concern. V'hayoz hamila b'shmini hum b'nei shekol balei chayim k'she yivaleid hu chalush me'od b'tachlis lachuso. The Rambam says that entities, creatures that are born into this world are born very weak. He uses the term tachlis lachuso, the sense of moistness being a sense of not being set yet. The body is not yet strong. I think I looked at the Friedlander translation just to see what he did with it, and I think he said tender. Okay. It's as though it's still in utero. Ad sof shiva yamim, until the end of 7 days. It needs a week to sort of get settled. And then is a proper inhabitant of this world. And the Rambam brings you an analogy. He points out the leaning that from Parshas Re'eh on the 8th day of Pesach outside of Israel, right? It's also done on Shemini Atzeres. It's also done on the 2nd day of Shavuos. It includes Kol HaBachor, right? We're familiar, right? This year, actually, it's going to be Aser Taser because it's Shabbos, right? Assuming we're not all in Eretz Yisrael with a Beis HaMikdash, so we'll be leaning Aser Taser and Kol HaBachor. But either way, you're told about bringing the Bachor as a korban, and you're told for 7 days you have to wait, Shivas Yamim Yehiyah Imimo, for 7 days it stays with its mother, and then on the 8th day, it's eligible to be brought as a korban. So the Rambam says, why is it that you have to wait till day 8? Kilu Kodem Zehu Nefel, as though it's a Nefel beforehand, meaning it is not considered to be fully viable yet, or we can't determine its viability yet. So too, human beings need a week first. And it's a fixed number, meaning it's not going to vary like, well, this species or this person seems to be more viable, so we'll do Bris Milah earlier, even though that's exactly what we do when it comes to a delayed Bris. Right? Meaning the doctor says, this kid doesn't look right yet, you're not ready, so you evaluate, and when the kid is ready, you do it. But he says, no, it's a set number, it's after day 7. That's the Rambam's explanation. He's not the inventor of the idea. The Medrash in Dvarim Rabbah is an earlier source saying this, in source number 2. Right? It's Hashem's mercy to wait until he is strong. It's a very interesting idea, this idea that it's a medical thing. I have been told by physicians that there are, in fact, issues of clotting or whatever that are better. At the same time, I've also been given to understand that when non-Jews do circumcision in the hospital for their own reasons, they tend to do it day one, day two, day three, whatever it is. I can't imagine they do it day one. But day two, day three, whatever, they do it early on. They don't wait, even though... Yeah, I'm told that there is something to be said medically about waiting for day 8. But that's the idea. Why Davka day 8? So the Torah Tmima has a nice discussion on this issue in general of the different reasons. And the Torah Tmima says that it's because Shabbos provides strength. And by day 8, you've definitely gone through a Shabbos. The Shabbos will provide strength. Okay, good. So your first approach... this Rambam Dvarim Rabba approach is that it's day 8 because that's when it's medically better. But otherwise, it really should have been right in the beginning. Then you have a second approach, and this is chronologically earlier, and that's the Gemara Nida. So the Gemara Nida points to the fact that the Torah states that the husband and wife are going to be apart, right? She's going to be treated as a Nida for the first 7 days. So the result of that is that they're going to be sad. This is part of a longer discussion in the Gemara about how the general joy and sadness after a birth goes. But take a look at source number 3. Why does the Torah say Bris Mila should be on day 8? Because everybody else is celebrating, and the husband and wife, because they are apart from each other, they're going to be sad. They're going to be upset. So it should have been day 1, but we're not going to do it on day 1. Although Rashi there actually says, as opposed to day 7, which is not so clear cut. The commentators discussed that, but I'm going to take the view that it could have been day 1, and instead we're going to wait for day 8 so that the parents should not be sad that they are apart from each other. So there's a fascinating line from the Vilna Gaon. If you ever use the Bar Ilan to read a Gemara, so they offer you all sorts of interesting commentaries on it, and one of them is Daf al Hadaf, which collects all sorts of very interesting, for lack of a better term, comments from Achronim that you won't find randomly, but they found them randomly and collected it. So there's a piece from the Gra in Elios Eliyahu that the Gra was sitting with his students. Take a look at source number 4. I quoted it from the Daf Al Hadaf there. Hagon Mivilna Zal Yashav Panim Chever Tamidav Be'er Shabbos. The Vilna Gaon was sitting on a Friday with a group of his students. V'shal Osim HaGra Im Hechinu Shum Le'achol B'Shabbos Kefi Takanas Ezra. And the Gra asks them whether they had prepared garlic to eat Friday night, in accordance with Ezra's Takana. The Gemara in Bava Kama Daf Pei Beis mentions 10 enactments of Ezra, and one of them is to eat garlic on Friday night. What's the rationale? Are you familiar with this? So the rationale for it is supposed to be that the garlic will enable the husband to take his part in the act of Ona. Right, you're familiar with what Ona is? This does not require a graphic discussion. Okay, so apparently it does. There's She'er Ksus V'Ona. These are three core obligations that the Torah mentions that a man has towards his wife. She'er, he has to provide food for her. Ksus, he has to provide clothing for her. And Ona is conjugal relations from time to time. And the question of what the timing is depends on what her expectations are, which depends on what his career is, and the Gemara goes into it in Ksuvos. But the basic Ona is supposed to be weekly, and Friday night is considered to be appropriate for it. And therefore, one is supposed to have garlic in order to ensure, because garlic somehow has these properties that it will ensure that he's able to participate in Ona Friday night. So that's Ezra's Takana. The Mishnah Berurah brings this in Or HaChaim Reish Pei. The Mishnah Berurah actually brings that you should have the garlic, although he knows, the Sefer Hasidim says that it depends on how the garlic is prepared. Meaning, I think it's that raw garlic will inhibit roasted garlic is good. And the Aruch HaShulchan throws up his hands and says, we're not really clear on any of this. We don't want to do anything that's going to inhibit the process. So maybe better just to leave. He says, people just leave the whole garlic thing out. But in any case, look at the story here. So Vilna Gaon asks the students, Nu, did you make the garlic? And the students look at him like, what are you talking about? We're single. What are you talking about? Why would we be doing that? And the Gra's response is, then the Bris Mila shouldn't be on day 8. Punchline. What does that mean? what are you talking about? So he goes on to quote the Chayei Adam explaining this. The Chayei Adam being apparently a Talmud of the Gra and being present for this conversation, and the Gra approving of the Chayei Adam's explanation. What he's saying is this. The reason for Mila being on day 8, according to the Gemara Nida, is the husband and wife are unhappy, right? Because they're apart for the first 7 days. In our day, the way that we practice the laws of Nida, they're going to be apart longer than 7 days, right? Because the way we practice the laws of Nida is that if a woman sees dam, then she waits 7 days first, till the end of the bleeding, and then another 7 days, seven clean days, 7 days of non-bleeding whatsoever before she can go to mikvah. So therefore you should push Mila until after day 14. Right? According to that, you should be waiting until day 14 for her to go to mikvah, for them to do the Bris Mila. And that's what the Vilna Gaon's point is, that if we're really going to go based on the reason for something, if that's going to determine our practice, then we should move Mila to day 14. So, just like we don't move Mila to day 14, you should still have garlic even if you're single. That's his rather novel argument. I mean, on one hand, you're talking about a mitzvah saseh d'oraisa with a penalty of kares for missing it, right, in Mila. And then on the other hand, you have this practice of eating garlic, so he'll be able to fulfill Ona that Ezra was metakin, that Ezra enacted. The two don't really seem to be analogous. Sort of on the order of the Rambam's analogy of bringing an animal as a carbon and doing a bris for a human being. Also, I think not entirely analogous. But it does seem strange, this analogy. But that's the idea, is that don't go based on the reasons. If there's an enactment that you should have garlic, then you should have garlic. And even if it doesn't make sense for you, there's another reason to have garlic. Ezra wouldn't just create it for one reason. There are multiple reasons, and therefore go ahead and have garlic. That's what he's saying. As I said, the Aruch HaShulchan says we don't really do this. Ezra said we do. Okay, but your second approach, going back to where we came from on this, is now you understand why yesterday's shiur had a few tangents. I'll explain after. The Gemara here says that that it's about the parents not being sad. Then you have a third explanation in the Medrash Tanchuma. The Medrash Tanchuma says, no, that's what are you talking about? Kach Shana Rabbeinu Kata Nima Lishmona. We are taught that Bris is on day 8. Matam, why? Kishem Shanimol Yitzhak Avinu. Because that's when Yitzhak had his Bris. Yitzhak had his Bris on day 8. Nu. So that's when you do Bris Mila. You do Bris Mila on day 8. Now, Yishmael had his Bris at year 13. But we're not descendants of Yishmael. We're not going to follow him. We're going to have Bris Mila on day 8. That's the third approach. It is particularly interesting because the Rambam's view, as he writes in his commentary to the Mishnah on Chulin, is that we do Bris Mila not because of Abraham's Bris of Yitzhak. We do Bris Mila because of our Parsha, because of Parsha's Tazria, which says, on the eighth day, do Bris Mila. When a mitzvah appears pre-Sinai, it requires some reiteration post-Sinai. That's its own discussion. Look at the Rambam in his comments on Gid Hanasha. But that's the idea. So really, you could have made the argument that, I don't do it on the day when Yitzhak had his Bris. Yitzhak had it on day 8. Fine. Well, you're going to do it on day 1. Right, and he does not explain why. Right. This Medrash is not explaining why Yitzhak is on day 8. The Torah Tamima there says clearly it wasn't because of Nida. Why? Because the Torah hasn't yet been given. So he says clearly it's not about Nida. However, that's problematic. The reason why that's problematic is we have a Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, somewhere in Daf Yud Aleph, that talks about Sarah observing Nida, right? Based on two things. Number one, in the beginning of Parshas Vayera, right? When they're breaking down the different jobs of what to prepare for the malachim, right? Malachim, anashim, whatever they are. So, what's the what is Sarah's job? Make bread. Lushivas Yuga, right? She's supposed to make bread. When Avraham serves the malachim, what does he give them? Chema v'chalav, right? Butter and milk. And ben avakara sharasa, and he gives them the meat, right? Leave aside the milk meat question. That's what he did. So, where'd the bread go? So the simple pshat answer is, well, what do you think he did with the butter? Obviously, he gave the bread also, and it's just, you know, maybe Sarah brought it out, or whatever it is, right? But the Gemara says no. The Gemara says, Sarah became a nida, and they observed a high level of tuma and tahara, such that they wouldn't serve the bread. That's the idea that she observed neither. That's based on that, on the absence of the bread from being served, but also because when the malachim say she's going to have a baby, and she hears this and she says acharei velosi haisali edna, which on a literal read means after I was worn out, meaning after I already aged, right? Shall I now be rejuvenated? Am I now going to become young again? Right? The literal read would be it's an expression of surprise and disbelief. However, the Gemara says, no, she's saying, Acharei velosi haisali edna. After I became old, I actually was rejuvenated, meaning that she actually did have dam. And so she became another hint towards the idea that she was a nida at that point. Either way, that Gemara indicates that they did observe nida. So it appears, unless you're going to say, well, they kept an assay, they didn't keep a losa, maybe they kept it as a chumrah, as opposed to like bris milah. You can give answers. But the bottom line out of this, and what interests me out of all of this, is that you get three different levels in bris milah. Right? Meaning, your first approach, the Rambam's approach, views bris milah surgery. So it's not safe till day 8. Your second approach is it's a family celebration. Everybody is rejoicing, so let's do it when they can rejoice. And then your third approach is that it's a ritual marking the continuity of the Jewish people, and just like Yitzchak has it on day 8, we do it on day 8 as well. So it's fascinating to see sort of different levels to Bris Milah. Okay. Second piece of this. Why does the woman bring a carbon chatas after giving birth? What idea have you heard before? There's a classic idea, it's in a Gemara, that people usually say.
That when she was giving birth, it was in all the pain. Probably said something which she kept saying.
Right. So Jay is familiar with the Gemara Nida in source number 7. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was asked by his Talmidim, why in the world does she have to bring a karban? And he said, when she is entering into labor, she says, I never want to be with my husband again. If this is what it's going to lead to, I don't want any part of this. So that's a shvua, that's an oath, and therefore she has to bring the karban. Rabbi Yosef says, what are you talking about? Number one, that makes her intentional violator. You need regret for it, right? You have to have harat. You don't just bring carbon stam. You have to, you know, there has to be an element of regret. I'm not actually sure that I translated that properly. I'm going to skip that for right now just because of time. But further, he says it's the wrong carbon. A person who takes such a shvua, maybe they bring an asham, they don't bring a chatas. So he does not like this answer of the Gemara in Anita. I don't want to use the word real. But the answer that seems to be the most straightforward answer is actually the Gemara Krisos in source number 6. And that is, I'm going to say it outside because it's a little bit convoluted in terms of walking you through the stages in the Gemara, but I'll say it outside. The Gemara asks a question. Let's say, not one of you, because no one of you would ever do this, but let's say somebody committed an avera, a shogeg, they had to bring a carbon chatas. For whatever reason, they didn't get around to it before Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur came, they did tshuva, they did vidui, and so on. Yom Kippur went. Do they still have an obligation to bring a chatas?
Doesn't Yom Kippur mechaper?
That's the question. The answer is no, you have to bring a chatas still. Yom Kippur will not take care of that obligation. However, if they're not sure whether they committed an avera, so they have to bring an asham talui, then if they pass the Yom Kippur, I believe asham talui is eliminated, if I remember correctly. But the Gemara says here is, what about a case of a woman who isn't sure whether she has to bring a carbon after giving birth? And this can happen if a woman has some level of miscarriage, and we're not sure, was it viable enough such that it was considered a fetus such that she would have to bring a carbon afterward? That's the question the Gemara is asking going into this. And Rav Hoshaya says that Yom Kippur takes care of chei l'chol chatosam, but not kol tumosam, not all of their tumot. And what he's trying to tell you is, the carbon chatas is not atonement for sin that she brings. The carbon chatas that she brings is simply a remedy for impurity. Remember that we said, she has this period of time when she is impure first, automatically. Then she has this period of time when she can't be anida, but she can't eat carbonos during that time. She can't eat kachim. At the end of that period of time, she brings her carbon chatas, and that's what makes her eligible. So the view here of Rav Hoshaya is, that's why you bring the carbon. It's just a formal ritual. Then why do we call it a carbon chatas? Because the rituals that are performed with it are the same rituals that are commonly performed with the much more standard and frequent carbon, that is the carbon chatas. What do you mean? Where you shecht it, where you place the dam, the fact that the kohenim eat it, they treat it as kachim kachim, high-level carbon, all of those are the trappings of a carbon chatas, so we call it a carbon chatas. The same thing is true regarding nazir. You've all heard the famous Bar Torah, which comes out of the Gemara, that the nazir brings a carbon chatas because he pained himself by not drinking wine. However, this Gemara also says regarding the Nazir, no, that's not why. It's called a carbon chatas because it's the class of carbon. But no chait has actually been committed. Not to take away from that very beautiful Dvar Torah about painting yourself by abstaining from the pleasures that are mutter, but that's the straight read. So we have two different explanations. One explanation is the standard one, it's her shavua, it's her oath. The other explanation is it's not a carbon chatas at all. Then you get the Rama in the Taras HaOla in source number 8. I am getting my mileage out of the Taras HaOla. The Taras HaOla says it's actually entirely different. It's education for the couple. Remember that his view on carbonos in general is that they're about education. We talked about that. The idea of learning that this world is a world in which things are destroyed, they exist and they're destroyed, and then Hashem replenishes them. So here, as this couple returns to conjugal life, it's important to have a carbon which teaches us about Hashem creating the world and mortality of the human being and punishments and so forth. It's an educational experience, as I brought you my translation in source number 8, to get them to avoid sinning in this area of conjugal life. This will be their lesson. And then the last explanation I bring here is a Ramban, which is not taken from the discussion in Tazria. This is where the Shemos are. But rather in Parshas Naso regarding Nazir and the question of why the Nazir brings a carbon chatas. So the Ramban says that the Nazir brings a carbon at the end of being a Nazir because he drops in his level of Kedusha. Because he had been dedicated to service of Hashem. The assumption is that's what goes with being a Nazir. He brings you psukim that talk about Nazirim as being like Nevi'im, being closer to Hashem. Now you're leaving being a Nazir, you're dropping down in your level of Kedusha. So I'm borrowing that idea of Ramban and applying it here to the Yoledes as well. Why? Because the Yoledes was on a higher level of Kedusha while she carried a life inside of her. And as she goes back to being like everybody else, the Kotzker, I believe it's the Kotzker, has an idea in general regarding the Tumah and Tahara that come with giving birth. Right? He suggests that the reason why she has to go through this period of being ineligible to Karbanos and of Tumah and so on is because she's dropping down from this higher Kedusha that she had when she was carrying a life inside her. And there's more for a baby girl than for a baby boy because the drop is a greater drop. Because when she carries a girl inside of her, that's also someone who could produce life. So she had, so to speak, a double life inside her. She had her child and that child's future children. And so now she drops down in a double way, and therefore she has a double period of impurity. So maybe that fits with this Ramban, that she has to bring the chatas, again, dropping down. So we have four different ways to look at this carbon chatas. You have this sort of formal ritual way that says it's just a carbon that looks like a chatas, but no sin has been committed. You have the idea that she took a neder, a shvua, right, that she shouldn't, and therefore it's important as a spiritual correction for that. Or it's educational, like the Rama, the husband and wife are going to be back together again, they have to have the proper frame of mind. Or it is mystical, she has dropped down in her Kedusha. Four different ways to look at it. The last bit that I brought here is Rosh Hashanah Fal Hirsch and his approach to why there's a different period for after a boy and after a girl. And it's a fascinating idea. I'm going to say it outside because there isn't enough time for us to go through it inside. But just to remember, take a look at source number 10 from the beginning of our Parsha, where we get the instructions. After a baby boy, 7 days of Tumah, right, which she is treated like a Nida, she has the roles of Nida, and then day 8 is Bris Milah, and then 33 days for a male is the days of Tahara. She still can't go into Beis HaMikdash, she still can't eat from Karbanos, but now she will not have Nida status. For a baby girl, it's 2 weeks and then 66 days. So Rosh Hashanah Fal Hirsch is fascinated by multiple things here. But one thing that really jumps out at him is the interruption with the mitzvah of Bris Milah. Right? Who threw that in here? I understand that the Rambam says I need to have it reiterated post Sinai. But you, in the middle of your laws of Tumah, you just threw in, and by the way, on day 8, you're going to do a bris? That's true. Okay, and on day 30, you may do a pidyon haben. Like, what is this doing here? So Rosh Hashanah Fal Hirsch fits it into his conception of, so to speak, sorry, no pun intended, his conception of how Tumah and Tahara work. He says, Tumah in general is about the loss of free will. That's the way that he looks at it. So a person dies, a person dies, and obviously now they don't have the ability to be active, voluntary participants in a relationship with Hashem in this world. Person comes in contact with death under the same roof, physically touching it, carrying it, whatever it is, they're exposed to this loss of free will, and they become tamei. And the process of purification of Tahara is about restoring that relationship. That's his basic thesis of how Tumah works. If you look in his commentary to the end of Parsha Shmini, beginning of Parsha Tazria, you get a nice long discussion of it. It's also in the third volume of his collected writings. He has an essay on it. So that's his core idea. But higher than the Tumah, sorry, and according to the degree of exposure to Tumah, that will determine how long you will be Tamei yourself. So in other words, there's a little creepy crawly thing that make a person Tamei for a day. Exposure to a dead body, well, that's a 7-day period. However, when you're dealing with Tumah that is Yotzei Alav Migufo, Tumah that emerges from a person's own body, so the lack of free will that generates the Tumah is actually inherent in oneself, there can be a longer period of impurity that's going to be involved. And here he says a woman who goes through pregnancy and labor endures a loss of free will. She's not in control of her own body. These processes are happening and she's just along for the ride, which is, aside from being very scary, can be painful and difficult, and there's a feeling of loss of freedom that goes with it. And so that necessitates a period of Tumah. And because it's from her own body, it's double the normal degree of Tumah. It's not just the single thing, it's also a double. And therefore, it should be a 14-day period of Tumah. He does not explain why also a 66-day period of Tahara. He doesn't go into that. I suspect, let's finish the thought on the 14 versus the 7, and then we'll come back to that. He then says, with a baby boy, bris comes along, and it interrupts the process. With bris, you reassert your free will in your relationship with Hashem by having the bris done for the baby boy, and therefore that cuts off the need for the rest of the period of impurity. You have now rejoined the world of free-willing servants of Hashem. Free-thinking is different. So therefore you're done with the period of impurity, and therefore you can get started on Tahara for 33 days. And again, he doesn't explain the 33. Maybe what he's thinking is sort of 40 days is a standard period of preparation for things like Moshe and Hasina, like the Mabul, like, you know, 40 days, we do that. The number 40 is maybe that. But he doesn't write it out. He doesn't say it. At least that I saw. But the girl has to go through the full 14 days of impurity and then gets the commensurate 66 days of purity, of Tahara, that follows. That's the way that he looks at it.
Yeah. I don't understand, why he's bothered by the fact that there's a bris. Like, it just seems to me like Hashem kind of gave an itinerary to each person, like, this is what the man does, this is the woman, this is what the baby does.
So why not mention Pidyon HaBen? Yeah, I mean, it's just so strange. It's just really, I mean, you're right. If I wasn't Rosh Hashanah Paul Hirsch, I would have just said, okay, yeah, this is what we do, step A, step B, step C. But he is Hirsch, and that's why, that's the kind of mind he brings to this. It fits his philosophy very well. And he's looking at the whole picture and trying to put the pieces together. He also has another piece at the end here, which I have trouble understanding how it fits into everything else, but he talks about how there's also a double period of purification for the mother after baby girl, because she's going to have a double impact in educating her daughter, that somehow the father is not as involved in educating the daughter, it's more the mother is educating the daughter, and therefore she has a double period of purification as opposed to educating her son, where she's going to do it with the husband, so she only has a 33-day. I'm not clear at all. It's the last bit there, the last paragraph there. I brought it for you just to be complete, but I have to say, I don't really see how he's blending these two ideas. The core idea, I grasp, that it's a period of 14 days of impurity, corresponding to the loss of free will during the pregnancy. Baby boy cuts that period short. And then after that, she has this period of automatic tahara. She is pure, which will then be double for the girl what it is for the boy, before she can bring her karbon and sort of rejoin everybody else. Okay. Shkoyach.